From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the Czech Republic in the late 1800s, when a young girl, traumatized by the death of her siblings, set the scene of her own death. She lit candles around the edge of her bed and lay down, pretending that she, too, had already died. The girl was Justine Mahler, sister of famed composer Gustav Mahler. 8 of the 13 Mahler children died in childhood, and the tragedy and trauma of the experience cast a shadow over Gustav Mahler's music. Now, his symphonies are known for being emotionally charged and subtly orchestrated. One in particular captures the pain and suffering of child mortality. It's called Kindertotenlieder, or Songs on the Death of Children. The child mortality rate in Rochester is 43% higher than the rest of New York State, and half of Rochester's children live in poverty. We know that now. Well, the Tabletop Opera hopes to raise awareness of these issues by performing a new version of Kindertotenlieder. The event will also benefit a food program that helps kids in the Rochester City School District. We'll talk about the program, and we'll preview the performance this hour on Connections. Let me welcome my guest. Matthew Brown is a professor of music theory at the Eastman School of Music and a founding member of the Tabletop Opera. Matthew, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Chris Farnham is a volunteer coordinator of the Backpack Food Program at the First Unitarian Church. Easy for you to say. Chris, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Laura Sugarwala is Member Relations Manager for FoodLink. Laura, nice to have you
as well.
I've known Mahler's work for a long time, Matthew, but sometimes the personal details, sometimes you hear music and not fully understand the genesis, right? So just understanding the story of his sister Justine, who glued those candles to the edge of her bed and laid down, obviously traumatized by her siblings who died, the way it impacted Gustav Mahler, the life he ended up leading, the music he wrote, his own loss later in life. How connected do you think his personal tragedies and story is to his music?
Oh, profoundly connected. You can only begin to imagine. I mean, his family were a minority community. I mean, they were a Jewish family, and they were in a predominantly Catholic, especially community, and especially when Mahler came to Vienna and had a turbulent time, actually had to convert to Catholicism, and I think it's fair to say that the traumatic living situation under which he grew up, with his siblings dying, and the lack of funding, money that they had, profoundly affected the kinds of music. And you see it, the First Symphony with the funeral march and on Frère Jacques in a minor key, and just the whole rest of the pieces. There's strings and strings of very tragic, death-related kind of music.
And look, I know it's the last hour of the week. Sometimes we try to end on a high note, but in a way we are, because we're turning this, what is obviously very serious and tragic circumstances, all the way from Mahler to looking at child mortality now, but also on what we can do about it. We're going to get to that in just a second, because we are turning it into a positive discussion. I think I'd read even his brother, he wrote, and his first opera was written for the loss of a brother who died.
Ernest, yeah, absolutely. To riff on your point about the uplifting, there's obviously a lot of great sorrow in Kindertotenlieder, the song cycle that he wrote, but there's also the lullaby that you hear at the end of the song is really quite moving. It's, I won't say exactly happy, but it brings a sort of sense of peace. And a lot of the song cycle is, how do you find peace in the tragedy of perhaps the worst thing that can happen, losing a child? The songs aren't all depressing exactly. In our version, for example, of the lullaby, we're a chamber ensemble, and we have keyboards, and one of the keyboards, instead of using a normal kind of piano sound, has a toy piano sound, so that we can kind of capture the sort of optimism that a child's life could bring.
Well, let's connect that theme to now, because some listeners may hear this and say, well, okay, but it was the late 1800s. Of course, child mortality, infant mortality was higher, and that modern medicine has obviously improved that tremendously, to the point where if we're not exposed, especially to poverty, to see where the challenges can come up, it's easy to sort of miss that in our community. So I want Matthew and our panel to kind of tell us how this all came together, how we got to the point where Tabletop Opera is performing this, and this partnership that's happening. So let's go back to the beginning of Tabletop Opera. First of all, what is it, Matthew?
We're a chamber ensemble, primarily Eastman faculty and some alums and friends, and we are kind of self-funding, slightly guerrilla outfit. We do our own shows, and we specialize in multimedia projects, and we like to work with artists and archives. So for this particular one, we have a lot of late 19th century post-mortem photography of dead children at the time that Mahler wrote them. We have a lot of archival pictures of Mahler himself. And then in 2012, when we started, we met some of the Magnum photographers when they were in town shooting Rochester, and we were lucky enough to become friends with Paolo Pellegrin, who did some really amazing pictures of inner city children. And we did a race relations project at the Fringe Festival, and he let us use his pictures, and we have some of those reused in this particular show. So there's archival ones, and Heather Shannon and the George Eastman Museum were wonderful in helping us find period pictures, and we have pictures by contemporary photographers looking at the state of it. And what you realize, and what we found, was that back in 1900 it was terrible, child poverty rates and high child mortality rates. But Rochester, it was actually a leading city in combating this, and particularly the figure of George Gola, who was the chief medical officer for the city, did massive things to correct it and reduced it by 50% in maybe 25 years. Still horribly high by today's standards, but he did a massive job. And what was wonderful about Gola was he saw it as a whole community issue, connected with education, sanitation, and he was involved in clean milk for children, babies. And when I started researching this, I was just struck to read some of his speeches. And then I had read the Governor Cuomo's recent initiative, and the speeches seemed virtually identical to
me.
And
again, what Matthew's talking about is Governor Cuomo's initiative from, what, the last year or two?
Last
right?
year, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
to Gola. His speech, 1912.
Yeah, absolutely.
More than 100 years ago.
Yeah. And what was striking to me was the issue that, first of all, there were the deplorable conditions. I mean, there were so many people, children dying. But that it was a fixable thing, and it was something that child poverty and child mortality were actually indicators of the health of a community. And that, whenever you see it rising, it's a sign of much deeper social problems and things that we need to solve.
That's what Gola was saying in 1912?
Both.
And Cuomo
Both.
This time?
Absolutely.
So really, well, that makes me wonder then. If you look at a speech from 1912 on the state of child health, poverty, child mortality, and then a speech from 2015 mm-hmm. on the same subject, and they aren't all that different.
Mm-hmm.
Should we despair about that, or should we feel that that until there is no child mortality, that these themes will be sort of in perpetuity? How do you feel about it?
Well, one of the things that's striking about the rates back in Gola's time and today is that they're disproportionate. Different groups in the community are affected more profoundly than others. So we put up some stats to show that, middle-class, educated white women and children, the rates in Rochester are actually quite comparable with Finland or Norway. It's just minority communities that don't have access to education, the same health care and all of those things, are disproportionately affected. And that was the same in Mahler's time. He was a poor Jewish community, and they had worse rates than white middle-class rich people.
So you've got performances coming up here. And by the way, why is it called the Tabletop Opera?
Well, we use one computer, and we just pop it on a table and plug it in, and away we go. So we're a stripped-down kind of ensemble.
But multimedia.
And, absolutely.
And so you're using images and all of these things to kind of help illustrate the meaning of the music and the connection. So Matthew, Chris, Laura, how did this all come together? You're all in the same room together because of what's going to be coming up on Monday. So how did this grow? Can you tell us, Chris Farnham, you want to tell us about that?
Sure. So people from the church heard the performance at the Fringe Festival, mm-hmm. and it connected so well with the church's social justice work that there were conversations to say, can we team up and host a performance mm-hmm. at First Unitarian Church on Monday night that will support an effort, a specific effort of the church, which is the Backpack Food Program. Our program specifically serves students at School 22 in Northeast Rochester, but it's also part of a much larger effort at FoodLink that serves a number of schools in 10 counties.
All right, so that goes back to the Fringe Festival this past September, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did you get a chance to see the performance, or was it members of the church?
I did not.
Oh, see, you should be very excited then for
Monday.
I'm
looking forward to it. It sounds like a very challenging topic, but it also sounds like it's illuminating in ways that many of us are not. We don't think of life today for children as being like it was in Mahler's time.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think part of what my takeaway already for the hour is for many kids, it's not like it was in Mahler's time. Or for many kids of relative privilege, it's not. Mm-hmm. But for too many kids, it still is. So, Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about FoodLink's role now and how you're involved with this project as well.
The Backpack Program is over 10 years old. It's a little bit hard to put an exact timeline on it because this type of work has been going on for so long. And the program is designed to help fill in those gaps on the weekend when children who might be getting a free or reduced price lunch during the week wouldn't have the same access to food. So the Backpack Program provides about 6 meals for the weekend, and those are distributed through partners just like Unitarian Church who work with the school and help to make sure the kids have that on a Friday when they go home. And across the counties that we serve, we serve 10 counties, we're working with 8 different counties, and there's over 3,500 children enrolled in this program. So it does have quite a scope, and there's 82 schools that are currently providing this program somewhere in our service area. And in the city of Rochester, there's 23 schools that are involved in this program.
All right, forgive my ignorance, but help me understand then, because what you're doing is kids go home for the weekend, and again, because of various circumstances, we don't often know where the meals are coming from. But where are they getting specifically the food? The backpacks they're called a backpack program because they're kind of able to fill their backpack, or they're getting a backpack?
They're getting a bag of food.
Okay.
And it is those are bags packed by volunteers at our warehouse. And those products are usually donated items or items that we've purchased. And we provide fruits, vegetables, shelf-stable milk, and those are getting placed into a plastic bag, and then when they get to the school, teachers or social workers or other workers at the school are putting those into their backpack for the weekend.
So that happens at school?
Yes.
Okay. The churches as well, Chris?
So the church's role is to sponsor one particular school program, so School 22, which the church has had volunteer tutors at for 30 years. So we have a long-time partnership with this particular school, as well as Children's School 15. The Backpack Program is a wonderful addition that helps the children obviously eat over the weekend, but then be ready to learn on Monday morning, because the information that I've seen is so clear that children who are hungry, their behavior suffers, their learning suffers, as we worry about, it's not just infant mortality, but obviously all the crises of childhood all the way through our struggle with the low graduation rate, right? We need to be supporting kids all along the way so that they're ready to learn and not suffering.
All right. So they're not here necessarily beating the drum in this way, but let me go ahead and do that for all the listeners wondering, wait a second, does it sound like you actually need food? Do you need food donations, Laura?
Absolutely.
You do?
And,
okay.
And money donations, because we do purchase food, too. The shelf-stable milk goes into every single bag so that they can either drink it or put it on their cereal. So those funds come to the program partners. That's why it's so key working with a organization like Unitarian Church so that they can help access those foods.
All right, so the Monday program is going to benefit. Go ahead, Chris.
One thing that really strikes me about this program that I'll bet people in the community aren't aware of is you talked about the number of schools that are served, Laura, that there's many, many more schools that do not have a backpack program, and that's because they have to have a nonprofit sponsor to be paying for the food. So, the food can be $3 a bag, depends on how much donated food offsets costs, but so, you're talking about $108 per child per year, and we have about 58 students at School 22 receiving the food every Friday. So it's more than $7,000 a year. So if there are more nonprofits, could be places of worship, but could be others that would adopt a school, there would be more schools participating.
Okay. So if somebody called Food Link tomorrow and said, we've never been involved with this, we want to grow it. You've got need, you just need more resources to grow it. You can grow it. It can happen.
It can happen. We work with, and we do work directly with schools sometimes because they might have someone on a PTO or working with them in a community setting that can help facilitate the program going on and sponsoring it. But we will, we'll work with any organization with a school at any point in their process.
That's, in a sense, it's almost frightening because, again, how many kids are getting help by the backpack, the weekend program?
3,500.
3,500, but you could grow it. It could be more.
Could be more.
Which means that there's kids with needs unmet still.
Absolutely.
All right, that is really an important thing, I think, for all of us to hear. And Matthew Brown, when you talk about the research you did, whether it's comparing the time, Mahler's time, to today, it's probably amazing to some people to hear that we still have unmet needs, considering the resources that so many people do have in 2016 modern life and still looking at kids who are in poverty.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's particularly striking for someone like myself. I mean, I work in classical music, which is essentially a privileged
sure
community. I mean, you know, we and we're an area in which it's easy for us to separate ourselves from what's actually happening in a community like Rochester. And I have a wonderful office in Eastman Theater in the old building, and I have great, you know, 8-foot windows, and I can see out my window where the Rice Riots were. I can see the edge of Joseph Street there, and it's a nice reminder of just how close even my building is to a very different kind of life than the one most of my students and I enjoy in Rochester.
All right, Chris Farnham, let's say something for the audience that will put a little bit more of a spring in our step, because we're talking about songs on the death of children. We're talking about child mortality. It's heavy stuff. But when you see at least some of the good work that's going on in the community, I mean, you've seen it, Laura, you've seen it again for 10 years, right, for the backpack program at least.
I'll tell you what I see.
Yeah,
it's actually
yeah
incredible. So we're not required to do this, but something extra that we choose to do is to go to Food Link once a month and pack food for the backpack program, not just for our school, but any of the schools receiving
that's cool.
It.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, when we average 25 volunteers per time, and in 2 or 3 hours, we pack 1,000 to 1,500 or more bags of food, which is an astonishing sight that fills pallet after pallet after pallet. And we do it with ages 8 to 80. And the very cool experience of kind of coming together, and some people just show up because they heard about it through the church. They don't really understand what it's for. But we always talk about this food that you are touching is going home with a child on a Friday. And what I love is seeing 8-year-olds along with 70-year-olds and everything in between being equally powerful at making change. And that's, you know, we do it every month, and it's always uplifting.
We're going to listen to some of the music, just little bits here and there, and probably the versions we have, excellent, not as compelling as you're going to get Monday and Tuesday night. But, Chris, if people want to get involved and to do that, if someone says, I'd love to go volunteer, et cetera. Chris, Laura, you can
sure,
explain
I'll take
how to
that.
Do that?
On our website, the Food Link website, you can sign up to be a volunteer. You could call us directly and volunteer with the program if you'd like to pack bags. And if you'd like to donate, let us know.
Sure. And then people also, I mean, our group is mostly folks from First Unitarian Church, although they also bring friends. And it's a great way to introduce people to the program and the need by actually being involved hands-on.
I'd like to interject. One of this idea of optimism is something that we were very aware of when we did our setting. And I'm particularly pleased with the last picture that we show in our performance. And it's a really wonderful photograph shot in the 1950s in a slums in Glasgow in Scotland. And it has a picture of children playing in a cemetery. And for us, it all captures the possibility of children rising above their circumstances and having fulfilling and wonderful lives.
Well, to me, the first thing I think of, if a child is in a cemetery, the child should be playing.
Yeah, they're playing leapfrog over the headstones, truly, and it's a stunning picture.
Wow, from the 1950s, you said?
Yeah, Bert Hardy.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about a couple programs. Well, we got coming up on Monday and Tuesday night. Matthew, you want to have our panel tell us what's coming up on Monday and Tuesday, and then we'll start to work through the music. So Monday night.
Yeah, Monday night, Tabletop Opera is performing at the First Unitarian Church on Winton at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it's in conjunction with the Food Link backpack program. And on Tuesday, we're giving a repeat performance at the Interfaith Chapel on the University of Rochester campus, again at 7 o'clock.
All right, so if you can make it out to Monday, the suggested donation, $10. Up to you. You can do more if you want. Proceeds benefit the backpack food program that you've been hearing about. And that program, again, is at the First Unitarian Church, South Winton Road. Chris, people have never been there. Where exactly is it?
220 South Winton. It's between East Avenue and Highland Avenue at the eastern edge of the city.
Easy to find. And then the Interfaith Chapel at the University of Rochester. So both 7 o'clock performances Monday night and Tuesday night. And if you're just joining us, Matthew Brown is a professor of music theory at the Eastman School of Music and a founding member of the Tabletop Opera. And before we start to listen, I've got clips from Interlude 1, 2, and 5, by the way, Matthew, because the program is structured, I think anyway, in a way that takes us through some history and then brings us to the modern day, right? So Interlude 1 asks the question and then begins to answer it, why did so many children die in 1900, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, and there are many reasons. Can you, let's listen to a little bit of Interlude 1, then we'll drop it down and we'll kind of talk over the top of it here. So Interlude 1, Kindertoten leader Gustav Mahler, let's listen. So you're hearing underneath us now, Interlude 1 from Kindertoten Lieder. And first of all, Matthew, you just want to tell us a little about the music?
Yeah, actually, this is the first song of Mahler's of Kindertoten Lieder. And Rückert's poem here is juxtaposing the grief that the parent feels at the loss of their child. And it's just coming into sunrise and the idea that they have to face a new day and that that child who's died has shaped and brought joy to their life in some respect, but they have to balance that joy that the child had with the sorrow of their loss.
Can I read the lyrics?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now the sun will rise as brightly as if the night had brought no cause for grief. No cause for grief. The grief was only mine alone, while the sun shines for one and all. You must not enfold the night within you. You must not let it drown in everlasting light. A little light went out in my tent. Bless, bless the light that brings joy to the world. The light that brings joy to the world. You want to comment on that, Matthew?
Well, you'll hear coming up in a minute, there's two little ding-dings, little bell sounds that you'll hear. And they're generally interpreted to be the bells that are death knell, you know. Mm-hmm. And this particular is the first song. Those bell sounds come back later in the piece, just before the lullaby, into the fifth song. And we play a lot with that. In the opening credits, we do an electronic version of this. And I'm a cyclist, and they sampled a children's bicycle bell to make the soundtrack out of it.
And that's how you did, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful and sort of aching and haunting, but in particular, once you understand, and listeners of this program know that not only do I love classical music, but for me, I connect to it so much more when I understand what the creation was about. And this is hard. This is very difficult stuff. If you're just joining us again, 8 of the 13 Mahler children died during childhood. Though when we say childhood, it's not always infant mortality, right, Matthew?
No. Child mortality, I think, is usually run up to the age of about 5 or 6 now. And there are, that was actually quite striking to me, was the distinction between actual child deaths in childbirth versus the ones that when they sort of young infants. And they're both slightly different reasons, but they're both horrible to contemplate.
And if you want to know why the death rates were so high in 1900 for children, inadequate health care.
Yep.
Poor nutrition. I mean, those are the ones we've been hitting right off the top right here in Rochester.
Yeah.
But poor nutrition, inadequate health care, bad sanitation,
yep.
overcrowded housing, minimal education meant that in 1900, about 150 European and American children died per 1,000 births. 150 per 1,000.
Yep.
15%.
Yeah, it's absolutely appalling. And back then, they didn't know that that milk should be treated, and that's why Rochester was an absolute pioneer. Gola brought in these; they had milk stations where you could go and get fresh milk. And there was some debate about whether it should be pasteurized or not, and how it would be treated. But so we actually have some wonderful picture of the kids showing up in their little bicycles and tricycles to collect the milk.
That is great, because interlude two, you ask what was life like for Rochester's children in 1900. And by the way, another really tough part of the whole of history of the late 1800s, early 1900s, is for the children who died, and we're talking so many, often the only record was a post-mortem photograph or a photograph of a gravestone.
Yeah, yeah. And the gravestones and post-mortem photography were among the only kind of records. And it sounds gruesome to us now that they would take a photograph, but back then the photographs were very expensive, and so you didn't really have many of them taken during your lifetime, and the children's ones. And some of them are kind of interesting. We show several from the Eastman House. Of course, though, we find them, I think, a little more weird and disturbing now, because we certainly, my upbringing, we didn't really show pictures of dead babies, but back then I think they were understood them in a different light, and they opposed in certain kinds of ways. And then the Eastman House is particularly interesting because there are some interesting like psychic pictures where there would be the mother, and then through sort of slight trick photography they would show the dead baby's spirit behind the mother.
So it wasn't uncommon for that.
No, and again, it was very common around Rochester because of its connections with spiritualism. That was a big feature.
So interlude two, what was life like for Rochester's children? And as he mentioned, Dr. George Goler, the city's chief public health officer, did so much to help bring those rates of child mortality down. And in 1911, he reported to the city government that child mortality had dropped precipitously in the last 50 years, but again, even in the next generation, we'd see great improvement based on his work.
Oh, yeah.
And so then interlude three, let's do this. Let's get a short break. We're going to come back, listen to a little bit of music from there with the question of why Mahler wrote Kinder Toten Lieder. We'll talk a little bit more about the man behind the music, and then bring it into 2015, 2016, and beyond as we aim for much, much more reduced rates of infant mortality, child poverty in Rochester through these programs. Monday night, 7 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church on Winton Road, South Winton. Tuesday night, 7 o'clock at the Interfaith Chapel at the University of Rochester, the Tabletop Opera performing Kinder Toten Lieder. More in a moment. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, there have been national and local debates on paid family leave. From the presidential candidates to state leaders, urging legislatures and lawmakers to adopt paid family leave. But many in the business community have pushed back, warning of unintended consequences. So we'll have a discussion, a kind of debate. Paid family leave in New York State. Is it time? Talk with you Monday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
A new debut novel called The Nest looks at adult siblings who can't wait for their inheritance. For the 55-year-old author, the idea of writing a book was not inevitable.
I mean, I did imagine it, but that was like the way I imagined winning an Academy Award.
Talking with a first-time novelist later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That'll be this afternoon at 4 on your NPR news station.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Matthew Brown, who's a professor of music theory at the Eastman School of Music and a founding member of the Tabletop Opera, was just saying, I have good musicians. How many do you have in the Tabletop Opera?
Oh, I have the greatest musicians. We're flexible, the number of players we have, but for Kindertone Lieder, we'll have Federica Agostini, who's playing violin, who you heard a little bit of earlier, Griffin Campbell, who's a saxophone professor at LSU, where I used to teach. Federico is at Eastman. J.B. Vandermark, professor of double bass at Eastman. We have Darius Tarafenko, a professor of jazz piano, actually, at Eastman School of Music. Albert Kim, a recent graduate, DMA in piano from Eastman School of Music, who teaches in Oregon. And Brendan Lanigan, playing trombone, who's just about to graduate as an undergraduate, so he's only 22, I think. And then Chris Winders, does most of the sound and the visuals for us and technical stuff, and I help him with that. And then Emil Homerin helps us produce the shows and raise money and stuff like that.
We read some of the poetry, the lyrics. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis there of the lyrics involved?
Rückert, German poet, actually did a lot of kind of scholar, lots of kinds of Asian literature, a very wide, diverse kind of polymath. And he wrote these poems probably 50, 60 years before Mahler's song cycle. Two of his children died of scarlet fever in rapid succession in a couple of months. And then
we're talking about Rückert.
Rückert, yeah. And then he, so two kids died scarlet fever about maybe a month apart. And he just started writing. And the collection consists of probably like 400 plus poems. He just sort of poured his heart out. And then around 1901, Mahler heard somebody speak them, actually a recitation. And then he picked five of these like 400 plus poems and started to do the song cycle. It took him several years, during which time he met and married Alma Mahler. And then finished them around, let's say, 1904, 1907. He had two, by that time, had two daughters, one of which died. Mm. And at that point, he said, I could never have written this song cycle. I mean, I thought I understood it with my siblings dying, but your own child just decimated him. And then 4 years later, 1911, he died. And another very famous composer, Arnold Schoenberg, was a devotee of Mahler's. He went to the funeral, he painted a picture of Mahler's funeral, and then he wrote a piano piece that has the ding-ding bell sounds at the start of it. We kind of use that inside our piece for dramatic impact.
Well, you know, one word I keep going back to is just some of the haunting or achingly beautiful aspects of the music, but then you understand, you know, he wrote this having lost 8 of 13 siblings, mm-hmm. but as a parent... Mm. He, to be shattered by the loss of a daughter after having written this in 1907.
I mean, one of the things I like about our performance is it's incredibly beautiful, and there and the sort of love that parents have for their children, I think we try and capture in the way it's played, and the choice of other music by other composers, the Thelonious Monk's tune Round Midnight that we use at one point is something about grief of a lover, but you could interpret it as a child. So there's a lot of heartwarming things, I think, in Mahler's music too.
Chris and Laura, don't you wish you had taken a class with Matthew? This is one of these professors that you meet people and you say, this is a class. I could take a class from Matthew, people like that.
Sure.
Don't you wish?
It's great hearing from him now.
They're all looking forward to Monday night and Tuesday. And let's listen to a little bit of Interlude 3. As we do so, then, maybe I can read more of the lyrics as well, mm-hmm. though. But I'm told this is Kindertoten Lieder, Interlude 3.
Thank you.
you tell us about the music here, Matthew?
Well, one of the wonderful things about Mahler as a composer is he often uses really large ensembles, but when you listen very carefully, the textures are very thin and clear, and it actually makes it quite easy for us to arrange an orchestral piece for a chamber ensemble, because you can hear the individual strands very clearly. Griffin Campbell, the sax player, is actually playing the voice part, and he actually made his own part, and then we adjusted around it. But the saxophone is playing what the voice normally sings, and what I find interesting is that it almost sounds like an instrumental part to begin with. It fits very beautifully together as a chamber piece.
Can I read then from?
Yeah.
All right. So reading from the poetry there, when your dear mother steps through the door, and I turn my head to look at her, my glance does not fall on her face at first, but on the place near, so near to the doorstep, there where your dear face would be, when you, bright with joy, would enter too, as you used to do, my dear daughter. When your dear mother comes through the door, holding a shimmering candle, it seems to me that you always enter too, slipping behind her into the room, as you used to do, you, refuge for your father, all too soon, the light of joy extinguished, the light of joy extinguished.
For us, one of the other features of this piece is it reminds a lot of us of a lot earlier kinds of music. There's a kind of game going on between the different voices that reminds us of Bach or Handel, and there's a sort of sense of reminiscence that melancholy, reminiscence that's going on in this piece.
How long is the performance, by the way? Monday night, Tuesday night?
Yeah, it clocks in at about 46 minutes. The song cycle's about 22 plus, and then we have interjections that are probably 4 minutes each. So.
Okay, and if you happen to be just popping into the conversation, Kinder Toten Lieder is Mahler's work that he wrote for songs on the death of children, and it's going to be performed by the Tabletop Opera on Monday and Tuesday night in an effort to not only perform beautiful music, but also to kind of connect a tragic story and scenario, child mortality, infant mortality, in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, to today. Obviously, modern medicine, antibiotics, sanitation, much better today, but Rochester still has serious problems when it comes to child poverty, child mortality, infant mortality. And so the Tabletop Opera, as Matthew Brown was saying, connects these things, and often through multimedia. You mentioned photography.
Yeah, if you go on our website and see, click on Kinder Toten Lieder, you'll see what looks like a video. It looks like it's a film. In fact, it's not a film. That's just a rendering. We actually produce all our pictures live. We manipulate them in the computer using video processing. And the reason why we do this is traditionally, when you make a film, you either shoot the whole film and add the music after, so the film is fixed and then the music's sort of put on top. Or you might be Fantasia, where you have the score and then you make the animation fit the music. But we're in between. We actually have improvised music, and by having live processing of the pictures, we can improvise the pictures too. So both are being in the moment, both are responding to each other, and it allows us to wed the pictures and the music in a way that's, on the one hand, more precise, but you can change it for each performance. So I'm not sure what it's going to look like on Monday. I'm sure it'll be a little different from the last show.
Well, Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who's a local pediatrician, writes to us on Twitter and says, 22% of suburban children live in poverty too, and hunger is an adverse childhood experience. She adds a link there to the American Academy of Pediatrics, citing a little bit more on just the impact of child poverty. In Rochester, more than half the kids in Rochester live in poverty. But as Dr. Murray said, it's not just limited to urban areas. We know that. Though, as Matthew has said, we do see a distinction between in socioeconomics, certainly.
Absolutely.
When it comes to child mortality, child poverty, etc. So, interludes 4 and 5. asked the questions, what is life like in Rochester or for Rochester's children in 2015, and what must we do for the future? So we're pivoting now to where we are here as we move throughout 2016 and into the future. And we're going to bring Chris and Laura back in just to make sure that we kind of continue to shine that light on what's happening in Rochester right now. Foodlink does, you know, so much to help people in need, help kids in need. But do you get the sense that, you know, for people who are maybe not in that cohort, people who are not in poverty, they're surprised that there's so many kids who are vulnerable?
Well, I did want to respond to the tweet, too, and,
sure.
and also say that there are programs being run in Brockport and Irondequoit, and we would welcome the chance to talk with others in suburban areas or outside of the city of Rochester in terms of expanding the backpack program. And to your question about whether are others surprised about this, I think that sometimes, yes, even those that are looking into providing a backpack program can often ask questions about the scope of the program and are surprised that it's happening in other counties that we serve, that it's happening in rural areas. And I would say that volunteers, and Chris can speak to this too, I think volunteers are sometimes very surprised when they come to Foodlink and realize what child hunger and child poverty and child food insecurity, what we see in Rochester and the surrounding areas.
Well, and what I think is so cool about Foodlink and the story of Tom Ferraro is so wonderful of, you know, started with a person with an idea, like let's capture food that's going to waste and get it to people in need. And it has grown and grown from there. And when I'm at the Foodlink warehouse packing food with other volunteers once a month, it's an impressive operation. And you just think how much good is being done by people coming together, both, you know, stores that donate edible food that they can't sell because of a labeling problem or a small dent, but it's still edible, and people coming together with their time and their labor can turn around lives of people who are suffering. So there's so much power and good in that. If people realized that there is great need, hopefully they then go to the next step of, if this hits you in your heart, what can you do about it?
Yeah, what can you do? I'm looking at some of the statistics that Tabletop Opera have provided. I'm sure you're going to provide them Monday and Tuesday in the show. You also in some of the notes. And so, you know, Chris, I'm looking at some of the numbers from the Rochester Community Foundation's poverty report. So this goes back to now December 2013, and then the updated report a year later. And the community, I think, when we were told there's no city in the country of our size, you know, two dozen cities, that has poverty the way we do in terms of more than 50% of kids in poverty, the highest number of people in poverty and in extreme poverty, which means less than half the poverty line. Chris, I think a lot of people we would have known that poverty was a problem, but that made it very stark. What Chris is saying is, what can you actually do? And a lot of people can feel paralyzed about that.
Right, but everybody probably could pick up some extra cans or boxes of food and donate it, right? I've been involved with food pantries for a long time, and you know, while I might contribute a bag of stuff, my goodness, 100 people do that or 10 people do that, and it adds up. So, you know, you think about, well, what difference does it make? In December, School 22 had some kids write thank you notes, and we've shared them with, you know, supporters of the program. And one of them that just really struck me, I brought today, it's a third grader who just wrote, thank you for the food. This food is helping my family. Love you. And I just thought, okay, in life, when we do things like this, we connect with others. And life is about connecting and realizing that we're all in this together. So it's just a really powerful thing to be part of. There was also one of our volunteers who coordinates tutors at School 22 shared with me yesterday a story where she met a mom whose child gets this food. And their family, for example, has a third grader, the mother, the grandmother, and the uncle. And this family, the mom said it helps out most in the middle of the month when funds are low. And that the mom really appreciates the mac and cheese, the tuna, the corn, the small milks. And the third grader thinks the little granola bars and juices are best. It's like, okay, that breaks down this huge issue of hunger to one little kid on a weekend appreciating a granola bar. So it makes it, to me, it just, I can't get my hands around the big issue, but I can get my hands around a bag of food.
Yeah, I love the third grader who said, love you. Yeah. You know, that's a small thing, but we often don't even say I love you to our community members. And for that child probably is saying love you and probably feels loved, feels cared about, you know, when could easily, with life circumstances, feel unloved and forgotten. It's really great stuff. So, Laura, one more time, let people know if they just are kind of curious about volunteering, helping out with the program like this. Again, a lot of our listeners may be hearing about the backpack program for the first time. How do you help?
Call us, 328-3380, or visit our website, foodlinkny.org. And we are more than happy to have you come in for a visit, tour our facilities. Please sign up to volunteer, and we can answer any questions you have.
And so we're going to turn now to Interlude 5. What must we do for the future? What are the efforts to combat the concerns about childhood poverty, childhood mortality? What's being done, I think, on the government level, but also you're hearing what people can do on sort of the grassroots level. And let's listen to a little bit of the music from Kinner Toten Leader, Interlude 5. So we'll listen, and we'll come back and talk to Matthew about that. As we continue listening, Matthew Brown, what are we listening to?
The final song here. It's a storm scene, and the parents, I should never let the kids go out, and it's a kind of story about the ways in which parents blame themselves in some respects for their children's death. It's the most tempestuous of the songs. Near the end of it, it'll bring back the ding ding, and there's a lullaby. Mahler ends the song in a sort of more optimistic note. And just before there, we rewrite Mahler. And Mahler originally didn't want you to fool with the songs in any way. He wanted them all to be continuous.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so, yeah. And so what happened was that we thought, well, for some of the text stuff, you know, the facts, we would put other music in. So we tweaked the ends of the Mahler song so that we can insert music by other people like Wagner or, in this particular song, we had some Schoenberg, the piece that Schoenberg wrote when after Mahler's funeral, which has the ding-dings in it. We inserted that in there. And so that was a kind of important thing. We do also refer to other pieces by Mahler. Some of you may know the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony, from Death in Venice, the movie, Visconti. So we were kind of careful to pick pieces that were either historically relevant, pieces that Mahler performed, or were written about the same time. But this is a really magnificent song, this one. It's really
and exciting. Let me read some of the words that go with it here, because I think you're right, it is tempestuous, the sounds of it. In this weather, in such a raging wind, I never would have sent the children out, but someone carried them away. Carried them away, I had no say. In this weather, in such a storm, I never would have let the children out. I would fear they might fall ill. These are idle thoughts now. In this weather, this cruel weather, I never would have let the children out. I would have worried they might die tomorrow. No need to fear now. In this weather, in this cruel weather, I never would have sent the children out, but someone carried them away. I had no say. In this weather, in such a storm, in such a raging wind, they are at rest as if in their mother's house, where no storm can frighten them, sheltered by the hand of God, as if in their mother's house, as if in their mother's house. Matthew?
Yeah, the ending with the God's hand is where the lullaby comes in, and the music takes this turn to a little more optimistic note. And that's why we worked really hard to find some optimistic pictures, like the one I was telling you of the kids leapfrogging over the gravestones to show how they could kind of conquer death and have a, you know, the rest of us can face these tragedies.
Chris Farnham, I know you've got at least one more note you can share with us You got time to do that?
Sure.
Give us some context here.
A friend of mine from church coordinates volunteers who tutor children at School 22 in Rochester, and there was a parent meeting yesterday that she was able to be at, and she told me the story of a mom with her family of six from El Salvador, and actually someone else translated the mom who was speaking Spanish. There's a boy in sixth grade and a girl in third grade at School 22. They've been in Rochester for 4 years and at the school for two. And the mom said, "We haven't always had the means to provide good food for the family. When there is little in the house, we're able to use the backpack food. We especially appreciate the cans of fruit, vegetables, and applesauce. And yes, thank God we are doing better. And for next year, we won't need the program, so it can help another family."
Mm. Yeah, that's great stuff. And these are the stories that there are so many more like them. And the program on Monday night will support the Backpack Food Program. So as we get ready to close here, on Monday night at the
First Unitarian Church.
Go ahead, Chris.
220 yep. South Winton Road, 7 o'clock. Everyone's welcome. $10 donation is suggested to support the Backpack Food Program, our program specifically at School 22.
7 o'clock start, and I guess you'll be done by 8 o'clock, Matthew.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're done within an hour. Yeah.
And then you've got a repeat performance the next night, Tuesday night.
Tuesday night, Interfaith Chapel, University of Rochester campus. It's the same group of people. And I think we're just as fun.
All right. So learn more about Tabletop Opera online where?
www.tabletopopera.com. And we have a long website with a long list of our other shows and our other multimedia projects with other artists.
And FoodLink, of course, is online where?
FoodLinkNY.org.
FoodLinkNY.org. You can learn more about this and many of the other programs they have helping people in our community. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for sharing what FoodLink does, and good luck not only on Monday night, but with this program, growing the program going forward. Thank you, Laura. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Chris Farnham, have fun Monday night, and thanks for the work that you're doing. Thanks for sharing these stories with us.
Appreciate your interest.
And Matthew Brown, I would have been a great student in your class. I would have been a bad student in your class. I would have loved it. I would have had no talent, but I would have loved the lectures. I have people on Twitter saying, "Can this man get his own radio show?" You come in with the kind of voice that you could put in a bottle and pour over pancakes. And Matthew, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Congrats. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, congrats with the success on Tabletop Opera, and really, really impressive. I mean, you heard about what they did in the Fringe Festival, now what they're doing with Kindertote and Leader, shining the light on some very important community issues and using art and music to do it. Hope you had a great week here on the program. Thanks to John Andrus, the engineer of the broadcast this hour, Valerie LaBanca, our engineer many days, Megan Mack, the producer of Connections, and I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend, and we will talk with you on Monday.